all know that how we get our news is changing. The old mass media, sometimes called legacy media, no longer have the attention of a majority of the population. But what does that look like in a country and democracy that's not even 20 years old?
And we know that everywhere the younger generation is on these digital platforms, that's mainly where they're getting information. But in Kosovo, it's really interesting. The majority of their demographic is like under 30 years old. Mm-hmm. So for them, this is such an important way of reaching audiences that are not watching traditional TV or listening to traditional radio broadcasts.
Right. The idea of an informed public is just as important in a 250-year-old democracy. You get it? But perhaps there's something fresh about the notion, where many people lived under much harsher constraints just a few decades ago.
They remember not having the freedoms, and then to all of a sudden, you know, now be in a democracy where you can actually have this and you can touch it and you can carry it out. That's really, really something that you could feel. And the idea of freedom of speech is, you feel it. It's very vibrant in terms of both the media, but also in terms of demonstrations and protests regarding certain issues, which was great to see.
So maybe a fledgling democracy can help us get back to the roots of why good, old-fashioned, fact-based journalism is important to any society, especially in the digital age.
I call it old school, new school, right? I mean, it's now more important than ever to, you know, find good stories, fact-checking, writing. I mean, writing's now more important than ever because you have to change your style based on the platform.
Right.
This idea of, you know, good sourcing and fact-checking, I mean, that is as important as ever. Combined with, obviously, being able to take one story and tell it across platforms.
Welcome to Newhouse Impact, a collaboration between WAER and the Newhouse School of Public Communications. I'm Dr. Chris Bolt. On this episode, Anthony Adornato is chair of the Broadcast and Digital Journalism Program at Newhouse. He's written a book, Mobile and Social Media Journalism, that digs into the needs of storytelling when TV, radio, and newspapers are giving way to Instagram, TikTok, and other social media as primary news outlets for a lot of people. As a Fulbright scholar, he took these teachings to Kosovo, where journalists are working out the best ways to tell their country's stories as their democracy unfolds in this fragmented and fractured media landscape. He also covers how he's teaching this multi-pronged approach to journalism to current and future journalists. The importance of democracy and journalism with a postcard from Kosovo on this episode of Newhouse Impact. All right, Anthony Adornato, chair of the Broadcast and Digital Journalism Department at the Newhouse School. Welcome to Newhouse Impact.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with something pretty basic. What all goes into your job at the extremely well-regarded Newhouse School, you know, for the school, the faculty, and the students?
Sure. So as chair, my main role is basically to manage the department. We have 500 journalism students, a really robust number. It's the biggest major at Newhouse by size of students. And making sure that we provide the best, most innovative curriculum to our students. And then the teaching component is obviously a big part of that as well. I was an undergrad there, graduated in 99, so it's fun being back and actually now running the department.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we wanted to talk about your experience in Kosovo. You spent 3 weeks there as a Fulbright specialist training journalism at Radio Television Kosovo. How did that come about? How did you even get in touch with that opportunity?
Sure. So I had heard of Fulbright many years ago when I transitioned from being a practicing journalist to higher education. And I initially, back in 2020, applied for a Fulbright U.S. Scholar, which is another group of scholarships under the Fulbright umbrella. And I spent a semester sabbatical in Italy carrying that out. So when I found out about the specialist program, which allows both academics but also all professionals from arts to sciences to apply, I jumped right at it because that first experience was so impactful. And these are meant to be shorter term kind of training programs on the ground.
Mm-hmm. I mean, for those who aren't too familiar with what Kosovo is, their history, et cetera, can you provide some background? What's their media landscape there, and what's the significance of RTK?
Sure. So Kosovo is located in Eastern Europe. The bloc there in the Balkans used to be Yugoslavia. It used to be a bloc of countries. It was predominantly, it actually wasn't a country under that. It was a region of Serbia. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty much dominated by Serbia. And then there was the 1998-1999 war in which Serbia came in and the ethnic Albanians living in that region, they essentially started pushing them out. And there was many deaths regarding that. And so from that, NATO came in, and years later, in 2008, Kosovo became an independent nation, a democracy for mm-hmm. the first time. And so RTK really represents the fundamentals of democracy in terms of freedom of speech and getting the information out there for what is, I mean, when you think about it, to become a democracy in 2008, a very, very young democracy. So in terms of national identity, and in terms of providing kind of a cohesive national identity and informing the public on what's going on, they've been huge. The other important role they play is during the war in 1998 and 1999, there was a major diaspora. So many of the Kosovars were forced from the country, going all over the place, from Macedonia, some to Canada, really all over the place. So they have a huge diaspora community. A huge community that still lives outside of that country. So RTK is really a point of reference for them as well.
That they would access from wherever they are.
Exactly, to understand what's going on in the country. Yeah. So it plays a very important role for Kosovars living abroad as well.
Can you take us through like what a typical day would be at RTK? I mean, you know, we're probably somewhat familiar with U.S. newsroom, radio, TV,
sure.
what have you, or newspaper, dying newspapers.
Right.
But what is it like over there?
Yeah, so I mean, I have to start out with like it was so impactful, and I really went in not knowing what to expect. They have the radio component and the TV component, and I was working with the TV journalists. Under their constitution, RTK, publicly funded by the parliament, they must serve both the majority Albanian community, but also there is still a Serbian population in that country. So they actually have two separate channels, two separate entities. Uh-huh. One that is the Serbian language, the other that is Albanian. So I split my time between both of them. They're actually two separate newsrooms. And I initially started working with the digital team, and they're really trying to figure out like a lot of places, but particularly there because they're so young and limited resources of how to reach an audience on digital platforms. Mm-hmm. And we know that everywhere the younger generation is on these digital platforms. That's mainly where they're getting information. But in Kosovo, it's really interesting. The majority of their demographic and the percentage I don't have in front of me, but is like under 30 years old. Mm-hmm. So for them, this is such an important way of reaching audiences that are not watching traditional TV or listening to traditional radio broadcasts.
Right. What kind of stories would they cover? Is it largely political? Is it lifestyle? Is it a mix like, you know, we would see on the variety of media that we consume?
Yeah, it's much. So I will say the one challenge they have is they focus heavily on stories that are kind of day of press conferences by public officials. Mm-hmm. As we know, that's a controlled narrative when you're covering things related to government, press conferences and things like that. So part of what I was working with them on is really going beyond that and going into the communities and telling the stories of local impact that are not being told just by going to press conferences and listening to officials. So that was one thing I worked on. We went from everything from covering a court case to press conferences related to an event. But then we also went into a Serbian community there in the country and covered a story regarding pollution in a river nearby and talked to families and then brought in the science and the experts and then what the public officials are doing.
What could you tell them about, you know, mobile journalism, multimedia storytelling, a social media strategy? We're just kind of getting our hands, you know, more used to doing that and you know, getting the multiple content out in multiple platforms.
Sure. I think for them, it was really starting with the basic training because many of them, their journalists are still focused predominantly on TV or radio. And then there is a separate entity that deals with the digital side. So it's really giving the reporters the skill set to say, hey, out in the field, I need to get this to push out on social media. And I can't just worry about my TV story because oftentimes there's a whole segment of the audience who's never going to watch that TV story.
Sure.
And so that was really key in terms of just very simple things like what can we do with Instagram, what can we capture, and what can we share throughout the day or at the end of the day regarding that story.
I mean, were they pretty perceptive? Were they sort of eager to say, hey, this might be new or different or more work, but it's helping us tell our story to people who otherwise wouldn't get
it? Yeah, really receptive. I mean, they were so appreciative. I mean, we know that public funding here in the U.S. is under pressure, and we know what's happened. But there, they're facing the same thing. But I have to say, the conditions they're working in, I mean, their facilities are bare bone. They're really the technology and the facilities they're working in, they rise to the challenge. So they're excited when anyone can come in and really share knowledge, particularly of, you know, the market here in the U.S., which is seen as more innovative than other countries. But the one thing I took away with that was in terms of them being super receptive and them really at the heart of it being journalists. Like, no matter where you are, you kind of still have the same blood. And that I really, really felt, despite their challenges of, you know, walking into the newsroom, hearing story pitches, and them really being concerned about kind of what they were covering and how they were informing the public. And so that to me was really, really rewarding. And I was so impressed with the challenges they're under in terms of financial challenges. Even in the fall, they weren't paid for a period of time and went on strike for a bit. That happened after I left there, but so impressed with how they're rising to the occasion, for something that they're really on the ground level of in terms of building. And it's new given that in 2008, they just became a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, a notion that they're a young, emerging democracy. Do you see parallels between what they're doing and what either journalists do here now or journalists did here 10, 20, 50 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the heart of it, there are young journalists in that newsroom and there are older journalists who covered the war, who were displaced from their homes. And I think at the heart of it, there's a seriousness to them, I would say, in terms of, because they take it so serious that they, as journalists in a new democracy, have the responsibility and a mission in their constitution. There's also freedom of press to take their role and really serve the public. There's a very serious element to them of making sure that they are carrying out that mission and that they're not letting people down and not letting the new country down in general, because they fought so hard to be a democracy, an independent democracy.
Well, and I could see how they might feel that they're way closer to that mission. We talk about it in public media or any journalist. Most journalists, as you know, despite what arrows and slings we are aimed at us, most journalists are in it for some degree of mission. But there, I imagine it's much more direct because the democracy is so young and there's probably a lot less media saturation.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the majority of them working in that newsroom and even younger folks just in general, 1998, 1999 wasn't that long ago.
Yeah.
So they know a life. The conversations you have with them, whether it's regarding their work as journalists or just living in that region, it's pre and post war,
right?
So they
very recently we
very,
talked
very very exactly
World War II right. It's 75 years ago.
Exactly, it's not abstract to them, right? And so, for them, they remember living under, a communist type regime, right? They remember not having the freedoms, and then to all of a sudden, you know, now be in a democracy where you can actually have this and you can touch it and you can carry it out. That's really, really something that you could feel. And while there was a serious nature to it, there was also a very young vibe in that country because it is such a young democracy. So the idea of freedom of speech is, you feel it. It's very vibrant in terms of both the media, but also in terms of demonstrations and protests regarding certain issues, which was great to see.
And that's pretty much part of the public. I was actually going to ask you about just the culture there. I mean, you were there for the Fulbright trip to teach journalists. But what lessons did you come back to the U.S. with about the culture there? Maybe something that journalists could learn from even.
Sure. I mean, I'll start with the culture. So welcoming. They really, really have a soft spot in their hearts for Americans because under Bill Clinton, we actually helped go in there and stop the killings and stop what the Serbians had gotten and started doing. So Americans, they have the softest spot in their heart for Americans because they, you know, according to many of them, if we hadn't gone in, it would be a very different situation there. The country in general, I mean, it's interesting because I think when you hear the word, you know, Kosovo, many people remember it from the war back in the news back in 98, 99 and afterwards. So this, it's an abstract idea. So it's very interesting when I started posting photos on my social media accounts. The reaction was like, that's Kosovo?
Yeah.
because it has a vibrant culture scene. It has this very thriving nightlife. And so the perception that many people have is of an old kind of block of countries there that aren't progressive. And so for me, that was like fantastic to see, super welcoming. And the plan is to, and that's part of the Fulbright experience, is to actually maintain that connection. So the plan for me is to go get back again at some point and continue the training with them, in fact.
I mean, would it be cool to meet with somebody that was in the training now and sort of see where they're at? You know, how much progress could you make? Resources maybe being an issue.
Yeah, and that's the great thing. Like working with their digital team, for example, in addition to the reporters, but their digital team, I mean, they just in the 2 or 3 weeks I was there, you could see the changes just on some of their social media pages in terms of how they were telling stories to speak the language of that platform. And so, of course, you hope they stick with that, you know, because once you leave, they're back to their, you know, resource constraints and the challenge that they have. But yeah, we've kept in contact. And so that was meaningful. And I know they have implemented some changes based on kind of just my very short time with them.
Well, you're probably opening eyes about a new way to get the stories out to audiences that otherwise wouldn't see them.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So you talked about the Fulbright program being open to a lot of people. How might somebody learn about it or get involved if they were interested, maybe not in Kosovo, but some other mission?
Sure. Yeah. The great thing about the Fulbright program is they have different categories of applications or scholarships. So the one I did is called Fulbright Specialist, and those are all listed on the Fulbright website. And the great thing about that is it's a short-term commitment. Mm-hmm. So it's a couple weeks to a month, maybe a couple months, but you can do them for 2 or 3 weeks, which is nice. And essentially, once you apply, you're in the system for a couple years and you have access to folks like RTK, where I did my Fulbright over the summer. They essentially put a call out into the system and they have this is what we're looking for. And it's categorized by, you know, legal or communications or sciences. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of look at the openings there. And I came across this one in the journalism category and it was related to digital. And I jumped at it and then I submitted my letter of interest and then we were matched up. So I would highly recommend it. And it's not just for academics. I mean, that category, the specialist category, it's for all sorts of people, including artists.
Yeah.
So it's something that I would say look at if you're interested, if you have a skill set and you're interested in, you know, it's about cultural exchange, right? And so like you're not only giving to them and learning about their culture and how they do things, but you walk away with like a really, really meaningful impact. Even my first Fulbright that I did in Italy, it was a semester long. I taught it at a university there as part of a master's of journalism program. And I thought, oh, okay, like that was going to be it after that semester. That was 2022. I know go back every May after the academic year ends here. And I actually teach a month-long course there because they asked me to come back. That's a required course for their journalism students.
That's great. Yeah, obviously the first left an impression.
yeah.
Broadening out to the field of journalism in general, what essential skills do journalism students need today that maybe weren't necessary a decade ago?
Sure. I mean, listen, I always say, I explain it this way. You still need the old school fundamental skills. Those are as important as ever. But it's also now taking those and how do we take those and combine them with the new school skills. I call it old school, new school, right? And so, I mean, it's now more important than ever to, you know, find good stories, fact-checking, writing. I mean, writing's now more important than ever because you have to change your style based on the platform.
Right.
Obviously, with the pressures and the scrutiny that the media and journalism in general is under, this idea of, you know, good sourcing and fact-checking, I mean, that is as important as ever. I mean, that combined with, obviously, being able to take one story and tell it across platforms. because we have audiences and we need to meet them in those spaces. I mean, I always tell my students, you can spend 6 months to a year on an investigation that could be award-winning, but if you're only packaging that, for example, for TV or for radio, there's a whole audience that's not listening to you or watching you, that's not seeing your good work, and you have to, you know, package that in on Instagram or on a reel that, you know, pulls them in, gives them meaningful information, and then you hope they go and watch or listen that to that full report.
Let's talk a little bit about your pioneering work in mobile journalism. You have the book Mobile and Social Media Journalism, A Practical Guide for Multimedia Journalism. What do you emphasize and what makes it a powerful tool for modern reporters to have that kind of technology?
Yeah, I mean, I always, despite these modern tools, I always start with the fundamentals of making sure that the tools may change, but the fundamentals of journalism remain the same. I mean, that's kind of like the core of the book at the beginning. And then we get into really how the tools can help us as journalists better serve the audience. Because sure, we work for a news organization, but the bottom line is our mission and are the people we serve. It's the public, it's the audience. So that's one thing I try to communicate in that. It doesn't matter the tool, but how are we using this to actually connect with the audience and bring them into the process? Because as we know, journalism previously used to be very one way. We decided in newsrooms what we thought the stories of the day should be. It was very one directional. And now, listen, there are negatives and positives, but now we can actually have a two-way conversation to some extent with the audience, and they can be part of that news gathering process. And I think, despite the negatives to that, I'm optimistic that in the end helps us build a better relationship with the audience, and then over time, that leads to trust, and then you're the one they turn to. It doesn't matter the platform.
So this concept has been out there that the smartphone, being able to take the photo and be it wherever, reporters can't be everywhere, that it's democratized journalism. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, listen, I posed the question like the first day of the semester to most of my students of, so people tell you anyone and everyone is a journalist. How do you respond to that, right? So this kind of hits home what you're getting at. And then we have the discussion, and then I tell them my take is the idea is that, yes, anyone can publish content, but that doesn't make them a journalist. It does muddy the water for us as journalists, though, in terms of just the flood of misinformation, disinformation that is out there and that we're actually competing with. And so we have that conversation, and at the end of the day, that has changed a lot in terms of how our content is resonating with people. Because we know, as journalists, we do our best attempt to make sure our stuff is based on is factually accurate, based on good sourcing. But we also know there's a whole segment of the population out there that unfortunately doesn't value that.
Right.
And we've used the term, you know, we're living in a post-facts era and things like that. And so while that can be discouraging, I always think and tell students of like, that's even more of a reason to do what we're doing. And at the end of the day, you're not going to win over everyone, but focus on those who do kind of find value in what we're doing.
Do you ever have, or do you have examples or stories that you would tell students or somebody else about things that people have done as journalists in the social media scape that are just wrong?
Yeah, unfortunately, I have a whole file on my computer of those. So when we talk about crossing the line and ethical dilemmas, I have plenty of examples of those. But yes, a couple of things. I mean, listen, if you're a journalist, there's a certain line in terms of even pre-social media, what we should be sharing in terms of opinion, political stance, activism, personal lives. And so my whole thing is we need to be doing the same on social media. I know that is not cut and dry, though, because social media also is meant to be a space where you can be personal. And part of that is lifting the veil,
who you are,
letting people in on like who you are. But this, you know, plenty of examples out there of when journalists have crossed the line in terms of, for example, weighing in on a certain controversial topic that's political in nature, right? And even though you may be doing that on your personal account, everything is public and you're a journalist. So if there's any chance out there that you know, for an audience member or the public raises questions about how you can cover something, that's an issue. And then, you know, other things just regarding how we reach out, for example, to sources in the middle of breaking news, right? Sources we know are, I mean, everything from school shootings to other events where they are turning to social media and publishing the content. They're at the scene. And so oftentimes as journalists, that's where we're going because we can't get to the scene yet or whatever it may be. And so making sure we're not crossing the line in terms of, you know, using content that is not verified or reaching out to those people in ways when they're in the middle of a horrific situation. And then there are other things that make for interesting discussion with students just in terms of like personal life and personal photos mm-hmm. and what crosses the line.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I imagine students who are just coming out of seeing their social media only as personal, and now you're starting to have to think about it as potentially professional.
And also recognizing that even stuff on your personal accounts, it's not personal. It's out there, right? And certainly that goes for any sector. I mean, the first thing, you know, potential employers are doing are they're Googling your name and, you know, seeing what comes up.
Are you hopeful that the future of journalism, despite all the challenges and changes the industry faces, is getting better? Because actually more and more people, even who aren't journalists, know about all the stuff we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So are they a little more aware? And is there actually a time where you're hopeful that journalism can say, well, if we do things right, if we're transparent enough, if we're continually proven to be factual, we build trust. And in fact, we can do that if we take the time to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's my hope. But I all in the ecosystem we're in, which is pretty much, in my belief, it's always going to be this, you know, mix of now we have social platforms and our audience are they're also content creators, disinformation, misinformation. I feel like this is going to be a never ending struggle of how do we in all this noise, in the mix of all this, how do we make sure that we're staying firm to the values of journalism, also being innovative, and along the way, creating that connection with the community in terms of our interactions and the type of content we produce that is building trust over time. But then I feel like there's always going to be that other force, unfortunately. And so we're just not going to win over everyone. And to be quite honest, not everyone is going to find value in what we do. And while that may seem discouraging, it's just where we are, unfortunately.
Getting back to your Kosovo experience and maybe other international work you've done, how do you bring in a broader sort of international perspective to teaching?
Sure. So a couple things. So we actually this semester, for the first time in a very long time, we're teaching an international global reporting class that my colleague, Colleen McEdwards, who used to be with CNN International, she's a professor at Newhouse, that she's teaching. So that's one way that we're integrated into a single class. And actually, as part of that, she's connected with the folks I work with at Kosovo to bring them in to talk about how journalism is done there. And then I think in general, like the world is small. So in everything, you know, in our classes that we do, whether it's regarding talking current events or whether it's a local angle to a national or international story, it's really making sure the students are aware of how we're all interconnected and how things that happen abroad impact us locally, but also when we look at what's happening, just you take terrorists, for example, and how that's impacting the international community. And I do find because how much the world is changing and has changed, I do find students now are much more aware of world issues than years ago. I get the sense they're not as insular because it is just everywhere and the world is small in terms of how we're interconnected.
Maybe finally, for the non-journalist, what would you want the general audience to know about the profession and those in it, especially at a time when, from many concerns, there's a lot of criticism, degrading of the profession and the people in it?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, at the end of the day, particularly when it comes to local journalism, it's we're your next door neighbors. It's actually a very, what I call, scrappy profession. Like, we are out there doing the research, you know, knocking on doors, trying to talk to people who don't want to talk to us, trying to, you know, cover topics and stories that we think will have a real impact. And I think that's important to remember, because I think there is a sense of like what's behind the curtain, what's behind the veil. And to a large extent, I mean, the fundamentals that we're teaching, it's all about being researchers as well. It's all about how do we be research in terms of finding good story ideas and developing those and really caring about the community. I think, listen, you don't get in journalism to get paid well, right? So just having said that, most people in journalism are in it because of the mission. They really, really, truly believe in the mission. And for them, that becomes part of their identity.
Yeah, I've often said that a good journalist has to be a sociologist. You have to be concerned with who people are, what they do, why they do it.
Exactly. I mean, you really are dipping into many different communities, and you are interviewing, you're observing. So a little bit of it is ethnographic in nature, and then taking that away. So, you know, it's not an exact science, but it is an art combined with certain elements in terms of fact-checking and getting different perspectives that allows us as best as we can to come to some sort of truth in our storytelling.
What's next for you?
For me, so I... Not
that you don't have a lot to do as the department chair here.
Yeah, so I will be on a sabbatical in spring of next year, and I'm already talking with the folks at RTK about going back there and spending a longer amount of time there, actually, maybe a month or so, because I really formed a special connection and bond with them. And so my plan is to go back there for maybe a month and then looking at a couple of other related projects. But that's one of the big ones I'm excited about.
All right. Yeah. Well, very good. Dr. Anthony Adornato, Broadcast and Digital Journalism Department Chair here at Newhouse. Thanks for joining us on Newhouse Impact.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of Newhouse Impact, a collaboration between WAER and the Newhouse School of Public Communications with help from the office of Dr. Regina Luttrell. You can find out more about Newhouse programs and research at newhouse.syr.edu/research. The Newhouse Impact theme music was created by Kat Collins, topic research and guest scheduling by Maggie DePatri. Catch more episodes of Newhouse Impact on our website, waer.org. While there, you can check out other podcasts, such as Deeper Shade of Green, with episodes on climate change, waste issues, and pollution problems, as well as The Land You're On, with teachings from Indigenous culture. Finally, a request for your support. As you likely know, WAER and all public media lost federal funding. For us, that's more than $170,000 a year. If you enjoy our podcast, local news, sports, or other content, please help us close that funding gap. Your donation helps keep this important and valuable community resource alive. Go to waer.org and click on the donate button. This has been Newhouse Impact. I'm Dr. Chris Bolt. Thanks for listening.